I'm incredibly privileged this week to have as my guest Lord Mark Sedwill, former Cabinet Secretary, head of the UK Civil Service, National Security Advisor, now a non-executive director of Rothschild & Co, Lloyd's of London and BAE Systems. Mark's had a stellar career in the diplomatic service and the civil service. He talks more about it in the podcast. He's got an absolute wealth of leadership experience, and he's been kind enough to share a great deal of that in the interview, and I think provides some fascinating insights that I'm sure you are all going to find extremely interesting and valuable. I really enjoyed the discussion. I hope you're going to enjoy it just as much as I did. I'm Bob Judson. You're listening to Leading for Life Stories. And without further ado, let's get on with it. Welcome, Mark. It's a real privilege to have you on the podcast. I'm very grateful for your time, and I'm really looking forward to everything we're going to talk about today.
Well, Bob, thank you. I've seen some of the other people you've interviewed. Good to be in that company, and looking forward to our conversation.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I want to start really because I know you of old now, and we've worked together a bit and known each other for quite a long time. But there's lots of our listeners who will not know much about you, other than the sort of the public face potentially. You've had an amazing career in the civil service. I mean, right to the top of that, and now you've transitioned extremely successfully into the private sector. I think just a short summary of where you've been and what you've done would be really helpful at the start, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, joined the Foreign Office pretty much straight out of university. Was at St Andrews and then Oxford. They now joke that I have degrees from the top two universities in the UK, and of course disagree over which is which. So joined the Foreign Office straight from university. First thing I worked on was the first Gulf War, and as a result of that, learnt Arabic whilst in the Foreign Office and had postings in Egypt and shorter postings in Syria, Jordan and Iraq. Iraq as a UN weapons inspector. Came back, did some jobs in the UK, private secretary to Jack Straw and Robin Cook, both of whom were foreign secretary. Then went to Pakistan. So my career sort of shifted, if you like, from the Middle East to South Asia, then went to Pakistan as the number two there. Again, jobs back in the UK, including an attachment to the Home Office, and then to Afghanistan as ambassador, and then the NATO representative around the time of the surge, 2009 till 2011. And then when I came back from there, I was back into the Foreign Office as political director, which is essentially the roving sort of troubleshooter, if you like. Great job, really enjoyed that. Then went to the Home Office for 4.5 years, ran that as permanent secretary, then national security advisor, and eventually cabinet secretary as well after the tragic and untimely death of Jeremy Hayward. By that stage, I'd done almost 30 years. In fact, when I left 3 years ago, I'd done just over 30 years, 31 years, so mid-50s. So wasn't really thinking of retirement in the sense of stopping and improving my golf swing and tending the roses. So decided, actually, I needed to think about sort of almost third of my career, probably another 10 or 15 years of active working life. And so I've picked up a sort of essentially a portfolio career where I'm doing some commercial work, so on a few boards, quite a lot of not-for-profit and charity work with the Royal Marines, RNLI, and some academic and think tank work. So I chair the Atlantic Future Forum, which is a security conference we hold on the aircraft carriers. I'm involved with IISS and other think tanks and so on as well. So now into a new phase of life, and have been for the last 3 years.
Yeah, definitely not much time for improving your golf swing in that lot, though. That's for sure. That's the incredible.
No, my golf swing isn't as good as it was when I was a student, alas.
Yeah, I think that's true for many of us. When you go right back to the beginning of that, though, what was it that motivated you, and kind of how did you prepare for the start of your career, and kind of ideas as what took you into the civil service?
So there isn't a history of being in civil service in my family. My father was a businessman in the food industry. And it was really when I was at university that my desire to join the Foreign Office, actually, it wasn't really the civil service I was thinking of. It was very much the diplomatic service was of interest to me. But at the same time, I didn't know whether I was going to get in. So I applied for some of the banks as well in the city, coming towards the end of the Lawson boom after the big bang reforms of the mid 80s. And actually what really crystallized it was I was offered a job with one of the big investment banks and I was offered a job in the Foreign Office. Obviously, the Foreign Office paying about half as much, if that, as the investment bank job. And I thought, no, do you know, it was really clearly tempting. Lots of other people were doing it. And I thought, no, I would really regret it if I didn't give this a shot. You know, I knew I had that nomadic gene in my DNA. I traveled and backpacked quite a bit during my university years. And I thought, no, I really want to try this life of getting under the skin of another country. I had a pretty strong service ethic. I joined the Royal Marines Reserves at university and spent some time with the Air Squadron as well as a result of that. So it was those things really came together.
Interesting, because that shift from mindset-wise, from public sector, private sector, and which to go for. I mean, I had the same thought when I was looking to go into the Air Force. Do I go to the airlines or do I go to the Air Force? And actually, interestingly, the catalyst for me was the airlines weren't recruiting. It was straightforward. There really was almost no option, which I'm so glad that that was the case, because I think I would have really regretted not doing my Air Force time. And when I talk to all my airline pilot friends now, certainly at the career that I had was much more varied, much more challenging in all sorts of ways.
And I think the other thing you realize in your mid-20s is there are certain things you can do now and some things you can do, some things you might be able to come back to later. So I guess I realized that I would be able to, if I wanted to pursue a private sector career, I'd be able to come back to that later. It turned out to be 30 years in public service, but it could easily have been 5 or 10. And I guess you would have found the same. You could have had your time in the RAF and then gone off to become a commercial pilot at almost any stage if you'd chosen that route. The thing I was actually most tempted by, partly because I had a big chunk of leave after my first tour in Egypt, having worked as a scuba diving instructor, was to bin the whole thing and go and become a beach bum and be a scuba diving instructor. And the only reason I didn't was I realized it was a great thing to do in your 20s, but it didn't look like it was going to be something that I'd be able to do in my 40s.
Do you know what? It's funny you say that, because I used to do a lot of scuba diving and I very, very nearly did the same thing a few years ago.
It's when you're about 23, 24, it's a pretty tempting way of life. It's a pretty hedonistic and tempting way of life.
Yeah, I was a bit older than that, and that's probably where the common sense caption came on, and I went, right, I'm not going to do that, because I think it would have been a bit of a mistake.
Well, actually, I realized there were people who were about 20 years older than me doing it, and yet they were still trying to live like they were in their 20s. And I thought, yeah, great fun, to be a young guy having this sort of life. Didn't look quite as cool to be a 40-something trying to pretend to be a 20-something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, interestingly, just before we move off this topic, one of the challenges you mentioned, at any stage you can jump from the kind of public sector, public service roles into the private sector. And indeed, obviously, in the Air Force, that's a lot of people do that. They go to the airlines.
Yeah.
I think one of the challenges I look at, particularly in the military, and I'm sure it's the same in the civil service now, is so many things that were major attractions and things that kept you in as a vocational career in the military, particularly, were the command opportunities, the overseas basing opportunities, the adventurous training, the sport, everything other than the pay, because as you say, the pay is not comparable. And I do worry a bit that I think for today's world, that's different. The pension scheme has changed. The pay has obviously not changed really, in the sense that it's not comparable to the private sector. And so it's not so much recruitment, but certainly retention, I think, is a really big challenge for all of the public sector world going forward.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think if you look at, say, the diplomatic service, which was the part of the public service I entered, the nature of careers now, most families are dual income. That wasn't the case 30, 40 years ago, but most families are now dual income, parents both pursuing careers. And obviously that can be challenging to do whilst one of those careers requires one to be mobile. When people ask me, youngsters ask me about a career in the Foreign Office and what it's like, I always say to them, really, this is a life choice first. You think about the career second, but think about the way of life you want to have. And indeed, the way of life, if you have a partner, the way of life you and your partner want to have. If you have that kind of nomadic gene in your DNA, great. It's the most fascinating way of spending your life. You get the chance to to really get under the skin of other countries and other cultures. You can learn different languages. You can have all of those different experiences, take up new sports, meet new friends, all of that. But it is different. It's not better. It's just different to the kind of settled existence one would have in a domestic career in the UK, whether in the public service or the private sector. So I always encourage people to think of it as a way of life. And I think that's true in the military as well.
Yeah, absolutely is. And I think everything you say about the family side is true too, in that, you know, most people are now dual income. It used to be a follow the flag world, certainly for the Air Force, that there was not only an expectation, it was a requirement that you followed, if you were married, that your wife accompanied you, and it generally was your wife because it was a largely male dominated service. And that made it very difficult for a lot of the wives at the time. And of course, all that's changed. It's much more equal in terms of opportunity for people now, people are tending to put roots down and so on in different ways. So yeah, it's definitely a very different game. And that life choice side is harder as a result, I think, in terms of marrying up the two things.
Yeah. I mean, modern working patterns perhaps might make it easier again. It is more possible to work remotely and so on for if people are pursuing joint careers. But there's no question it's a challenge.
Yeah, 100%. As you know, this podcast is all about leadership, and I'm really interested in your leadership style shift over the years, from early doors really right up to ending up as cabinet secretary, with all of the challenges that went on with that, and how you consciously adapted and changed your leadership style across your career.
I think I learned very early on, I mean, actually not in jobs that were essentially designated as leadership jobs, what turned out later to be significant leadership skills. One of the benefits of operating in a relatively small team in a challenging place, a challenging circumstances, and that was the case in my first posting in Egypt, for example, where there was a major domestic terrorist threat. Egypt was very much in the crosshairs of all of the issues in the Middle East, and it was a reasonable size embassy, but still there weren't huge numbers of expatriate staff there. Was that you just learned to shoulder responsibility. A lot of the public service is quite a hierarchical set of organizations. What they tend to teach you, particularly early on, is to push decisions up and, you know, give advice, whatever, but decisions go up. And what therefore tends to happen is by the time people reach a level at which they really have to take decisions, they haven't really necessarily developed muscles, if you like, in order to do so. And the military are much better at that. You train decision-making, shouldering responsibility in at a very early stage. That's what, in a sense, Cranwell and Sandhurst and Dartmouth and so on are all about. But the civilian side of the public service, whether diplomatic service or civil service, doesn't really do that. But the diplomatic service does it more because of the nature of the roles. And so, therefore, I was always comfortable with shouldering responsibility. I'd done that beforehand. Actually, being a scuba diving instructor is you're shouldering responsibility. You know, you're taking responsibility for the safety of the people around you. So I was always comfortable with that idea, being held accountable, making decisions, and so on. And so I think those things, learning those things early on, and in particular being held accountable, stood me in good stead later. I don't think I really had a sort of linear leadership journey because, and in a sense, I always tell people that you shouldn't have a single leadership style that kind of develops, you know, if you're in a very big job, is different to the kind of leadership style you might have had in running a smaller team. Because your leadership style should never be about you. It should always be about the circumstances that you are in, the needs of the team, the needs of the organization. And it's important to flex your style according to the circumstances you find yourself in. So I remember talking to a colleague about this when I was at the Home Office, actually an ex-military colleague who'd done a very, very senior role, played a very senior role in the military. And I said to him I said this to others as well, I certainly reflected on this myself. If you're in a big job, over the period of, say, 4 to 5 years in that job, your style should change if you're successful. Because what's required on day one and what's required 5 years later should be different if you've succeeded. It might be necessary to be quite upfront, quite sort of, you know, dynamic and individualistic and sort of big personality in day one, particularly if you're taking over an organization that's been through a difficult period, has lost confidence and so on. But if by the end you're still behaving that way, then have you really moved the organization on? What you should be by the end is more detached, sitting back, more chair, you know, in a more chairing, less kind of, you know, front-footed sort of style, if you like, if you're successful. So I've always been very conscious of cycles and rhythms of leadership and adapting my leadership style to the circumstances I find myself in. Obviously recognizing you have to be authentic to your own personality. But I do think that's the mindset one should always have.
Very great points. And that flexing thing, I totally agree with you. I think it's so important. And looking at the different audience you have and the different individuals you have actually within the team, some of whom it was interesting when I interviewed David Petraeus for this podcast, that he was talking about with some people, he could be really loose on the reins and just let them get on with it because they were really good at letting them get on with it. Yeah. With other people, he was, you know, they would describe him, you know, his comment was they would probably have described him as a real micromanager. And he said he had that skill too, because at the end of the day, you do need to do that sometimes. I totally agree.
Yeah, that kind of tight, loose thing. And yeah, but a consultant once said to me, I had a rather interesting blend of tight, loose, because you know, my starting point is kind of loose. It's build a great team, empower them, protect them, make them play as a team, but essentially then let them get on with it and recognize that you aren't delegating authority if you only let people take decisions you agree with. You've really got to let them take decisions they think are right and be confident in the choice of the people you make. But every now and again, you do have to be very tight. You have to dive right in and become, you know, go right the way down to the sort of operational or even tactical level, just in order to be sure that something's right. And that's particularly true in a crisis. But I genuinely believe that getting people to think of a cycle of leadership is important. I do remember talking to one colleague and said to them, what you really need to move on is from where you are now, which is where everyone's saying, you're great. That's good, obviously, all very positive. But what I want to see next is them saying, your department is great. And then what I really want to see after that is just the department is great. Because if you've achieved that, you've really embedded a leadership achievement. And I was always trying to do that in the way I approach things, sometimes to my cost, but that was always my approach.
Yeah, that's great. Just before we move off this, I mean, when I look back at my Air Force time, I always measured my sort of my own desire to continue doing what I was doing by two things. One was enjoying what I did, and I never had a problem with that. The other one was looking in the mirror and being content with kind of the reflection. And I always describe that as saying, am I doing stuff that meets my value set? Am I kind of maintaining my own principles? Am I willing to drink the Kool-Aid that I'm trying to sell to other people? You had at the top end of your career the obvious massive challenge of being at the top of the civil service, interfacing with a very dynamic political world that often is shifting sands and different governments, et cetera, et cetera. That must have been pretty challenging, wasn't it? I'd just be interested in your reflections on how you worked outwards to the political level and sort of inwards to the department and managed that.
Yeah, I mean that, absolutely right. And I mean, I think that was particularly true in the last couple of years when we were dealing with Brexit under both, when I was Cabinet Secretary, dealing with Brexit under both Theresa May and Boris Johnson, and then thereafter as we went into the first phase of COVID, after which I stood down. These were tense periods, and there were people within those governments who really wanted to shake up the system, not always with a particularly clear idea of what they wanted to build instead. I'm up for reform, but I was always up for reform to something, not just to change things. Move fast and break things, you know, is a phrase one hears particularly in Silicon Valley, and there's something to it, but you've got to construct something afterwards. And that was always quite challenging. I think, look, to be honest with you, and I found this in Afghanistan even a decade before, I think you have to be completely committed and actually pretty inflexible on your values but highly flexible on tactics. And really focused on, okay, what are the big things that that are important to me? And that might be values. It might actually just be a decision. You know, it's really important we get X, Y, or Z right. And then particularly in a big job, be conscious, okay, look, in the end, on balance, I'd rather we do this, that, or the other, but actually this is second order stuff. And if it matters more to someone else, let them have their way. And that might be the diplomat in me, a natural kind of, okay, find out where the room for compromise is, but you'd be really clear about what's really important, you know, as you're kind of negotiating. And that's sort of how I approached my last job in government as cabinet secretary. What were the things that were really important that I just felt I could not compromise on and had to hold fast to and defend? And what were the things where, you know, I could just, you know, even if I disagreed, in the end, it was kind of, okay, well, we'll let that one go.
No, it's great, isn't it? And knowing which battles to fight, essentially. I've looked over the years, and you so often you'll hear military and civil service, and indeed corporate circles, you'll hear people say, this is a resignation issue. No, they should stand up for their principles and resign. You kind of go, well, yeah, all right. But is that actually going to serve the greater good by them doing that? And, you know, I often it doesn't. And that's why they don't. But I don't think that's necessarily the perception. And it gets twisted a bit by the media and social media in particular, which can be very, very difficult in that space, can't it?
Yeah. And you can't, you know, it can't be the case. You know, sometimes these things are treated rather in a rather binary fashion, particularly in the political world by the media, and say, well, if you disagreed, why didn't you threaten to resign? Well, yeah, no team, politics, government, virtually any worthwhile activity is a team sport. And no team can operate on the basis that everyone flounces every time they don't get their own way. And therefore, you know, of course there are some issues where you should be prepared to take a stand and say, look, if this happens, it's something that I can't go along with, and I'll have to leave. And those might be policy issues, there might be behavioral issues, whatever it might be. But that shouldn't be the default. In the end, your objective should be to try and win the argument and try to ensure that the outcome reflects what you believe to be in particular the right values, not necessarily the right decisions, because those are, you know, people will disagree about those things, but certainly the right values.
And really, again, really interesting. I like to talk about role models when we do these, and I'm really interested in who you would consider role models, even mentors, across your career, and why.
Yeah, so I had a whole series, I think, and some from different professions. So because I've operated quite close to the political world, although I've never been a politician, thank goodness, there are definitely people from that world that I've looked at and seen as role models, including, you know, people from history and so on. But certainly in the sort of latter phases of my career, there were people like Dave Petraeus, whom you've interviewed, Stan McChrystal, his predecessor in Afghanistan, from whom I took different ideas, you know, different elements of their leadership styles. I have a completely different leadership style to Dave Petraeus, but there were definitely elements of his leadership style, this, you know, focus and commitment and relentlessness that I and strategic insight that I admired tremendously and tried to replicate. There was the authenticity and the ability to put himself into the mindset of the individual soldier on the front line that Stan McChrystal had. You know, you could see him thinking as he was operating as a four-star commander. How is this? What is this going to mean to the guy who's out in a forward operating base, you know, in a tough part of Afghanistan in the middle of absolutely nowhere? And I thought, okay, that's a really important lesson to have learned from him. Gus O'Donnell, my predecessor but one as cabinet secretary, great leader, came in with some big ideas about reform he wanted to make to the civil service, had thought very hard in advance about those, encapsulated them in a slogan. He likes alliteration, so he'd capture those, I think it was 5 P's. Yeah, it was clear he came in with an agenda, and he'd thought very hard about how he was going to communicate that agenda in a meaningful way, a bit like Stan McChrystal, in a different context, in a meaningful way, to 500,000 civil servants. So it was meaningful to them as well as to the sort of the more senior people around his own table. So, you know, lots of different people that I sort of, I suppose, picked up elements from and sought to apply and replicate in my own way of operating.
Yeah, it's very much what I've done as well, actually, is I've looked at people across the years and picked things that I really like and, frankly, stolen them.
Yeah, and what I think, and I think one should be, you know, I think one should be completely open about that. I genuinely don't think, I mean, you know, great leaders they're neither born nor made, actually, they evolve. And, you have to have some qualities like you do in almost any human endeavor. But you have to be really smart, work really hard, and evolve. And if you don't learn from the people around you, then you aren't going to be doing that.
Yeah, and it's both directions, isn't it, as well? I've certainly, as well as stealing good ideas and things that I really liked and thought were really positive traits, I've definitely, over the career, seen people who are going, I'm never going to do that. Because I think that's just as important to pick things that, you know, have really affected you and change. I mean, on a micro level to that, I remember when I was at Larbrook as a relatively young pilot in Germany, still back into the Cold War, we had a station commander at the time who was actually an ex-Jaguar pilot, but he'd since gone on to the Tornado. He was promoted rather, there's some events in the immediate front of this that got him promoted quickly from one of the squadrons to be the station commander. And he spent hardly any time with the one Jaguar squadron that was on the station. He entirely focused on the Tornado. And I never forgot that, because when I was a station commander myself, my old squadron actually came to Coningsby, where I was the station commander, as the sort of the last of the Jaguar squadrons. And clearly I was building up the Typhoon force, and that was the very much the focus of most of the effort. But I was really clear that I had to go and spend some time with them. I had to go and fly. I had 2,500 hours on the Jaguar. I'd spent most of my career flying it. So it wasn't a difficult thing to do at all to jump back in. But it was, and I think it really mattered. It really counted for the for them that, you know, that I cared. Yeah. I think it's an easy mistake to make, that you don't necessarily do that if you've got a higher priority and you lose sight of part of the team that actually are part, you know, are in your structure.
It's always tempting, I think, in a leadership role to be trapped, and your immediate staff will trap you into the cocoon of whatever your decision-making circle is. And I think it is really important in any leadership role to break out of that. And I used to, you know, when I was running the Home Office, I was really conscious. I would try and spend a day a week on the road, just going around, you know, spending time with, you know, on the beat with a police officer, or on, you know, at the border with some immigration officers, or whatever it might be. And I used to say to some of my senior team, don't put yourselves in a position where I know more about what's going on the ground than you do. Yeah, I am going to be out there. It's part of the way I operate. It's part of the way I communicate. It's in particular how I learn. And it gave me a really good appreciation for how things were being received at the front line across a very diverse set of organizations. And the other thing, just thinking about people from whom you learn, I can think of two ambassadors from whom I learned pretty early on. One of them, one of the cleverest people I've ever come across, brain the size of a planet, brilliant judgment, great, great diplomat. I mean, really brilliant way of sequencing the way he operates and so on, but really intimidating, and didn't bother not to be intimidating. And so I saw how that, I saw how that affected some of the people around him. And almost in parallel, working for another head of mission, who would be the first to say he didn't have the sheer intellectual horsepower of the other one, but who at almost every meeting started with a light-hearted remark, a joke, you know, a wry observation or whatever. And you could see people in the room relaxing around him and never being frightened to, you know, just chuck an idea in or say something, even if it wasn't fully formed. And I learned later, I remember talking to a psychologist about this later, who said to me, yeah, well, let me tell you how that works. And he explained the neuroscience of how the brain works. And essentially the second guy who was making people relax and so on was, you know, the synapses all open up and the neuroscience tells you that's what happens. And you actually make people more intelligent, literally more intelligent in the moment. Whereas if they're feeling intimidated, they go into sort of fight or flight mode, close down, and you're actually making them literally less intelligent in the moment. You're stopping their brain, literally stopping their brain functioning as effectively.
Well, that's really interesting. I didn't know that.
You know, I would, yeah. And so this observation I'd spotted earlier. So I always tried to model myself on the second guy. You know, start a meeting with a lighthearted remark, a joke, a bit of banter, whatever it is, just to sort of put people at their ease. And it was only later on I actually found there was neuroscience behind the insight I'd had from watching these two people operating. I admired tremendously the first, modeled my own way of trying to weave together diplomatic activity when I was political director, national security advisor, actually in Afghanistan. You know, how do you make things work? When do you need to act? When do you need to not act? You know, all of that kind of thing. I learned a huge amount from him in that way. But actually from the second, I learned much more about how to get the people around me to be smarter in the moment.
Yeah, style really matters, doesn't it? If you're quite an authoritative, strong leader, you just shut the room down if you're not careful. You know, if you vocalize an opinion, I mean, I always found as well in some of my command roles in the military that thought crime was a thing. You know, you could actually turn around and speak out loud when actually all you were doing was thinking about something. And the next thing is you find someone's actually changed something on the back of what you said, and you didn't mean that to happen. It was just, you know, that they, well, you said this. And yeah, but I was just thinking.
Absolutely, Bob. That happened to me at the Home Office one time, where I was taken into a meeting to have a presentation made to me on a program that we were going to work on. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, I have no clue why we are doing this. I just, you know, genuinely. And I said, who commissioned this? Yeah. And the answer was, you did. And it turned out, I really don't remember commissioning this. And it turned out I'd made essentially fairly chance remarks. The Home Office is a very operational minded department. Yeah. Boss says something, off you go. You're pulling levers without really realizing it. And I said, look, I'm really sorry. I was just thinking out loud. And I'm so sorry that everyone's done all this work. But, and it actually is worthwhile, and we'll have a proper look at it. But I really didn't mean to commission this. And so, again, I learned after that, because I am a fairly big presence. And of course, you forget sometimes, even if you think you aren't, you are in a senior role. You cast quite a shadow. I would actually discipline myself to say, no one wants to do anything about this, just thinking out loud, tell me what you all think. Because I didn't want, you know, I didn't want people to think that trying to be open-minded was actually a form of direction or guidance.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. That's a great point.
And it's particularly true when you're surrounded by operationally minded people. If you're surrounded by a bunch of policy wonks, it doesn't matter at all. You know, even when you have made a decision, it's hard enough to get them to do what you want. But if you're in an operational climate, like the military, the Home Office, etc., where people are really, you know, practically minded, they want to make things happen, almost anything you say can lead people to pursue some operational activity.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's an important point, I think, for leaders at every level to be aware of. And the more senior they are, the more relevant it becomes, that's for sure.
And it goes back to this point of flexing your style to the environment that you're in. You really do have to recognize that. As I said, it's not, if I do leadership talks, I say, if you take away one thing from this leadership, from this talk, remember, leadership is not about you, it's about them.
Yeah, 100%. I couldn't agree more with that. You touched on sort of traits and values in talking about your role models, but what leadership traits, values are really important to you individually, but also are the ones that you really look for in other people? What do you think is most important?
Integrity and authenticity, absolutely at the heart of it. I just think it's not, I mean, they're not only the right things to have for obvious reasons, but I just don't think you can be an effective leader without them, because people are really smart at spotting someone who doesn't have those things and isn't being authentic and isn't displaying integrity. So those, I think, are the absolute core. And essentially, almost everything else is a technique. And it's a technique you should flex according to the circumstances. But I think integrity and authenticity are absolutely fundamental. And I suppose the next one, for the reasons I've said, will be flexibility, agility and so on. But in a sense, that's a technique. I think the absolute core of good leadership is integrity and authenticity.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's, again, interesting. I agree. I mean, it's because there are lots of things that you can add to a values list. And I do that when I do leadership workshops and people as well, where we talk about what's important to you. But there are some that are really fundamental.
Of course, you've got to be decisive. You've got to be a good communicator. You've got to be an even better listener. You've got to be, you've got to have good judgment, not perfect, but good judgment. All those things. But a lot of that can be taught. Not all of it, but a lot of it can be taught. I just don't think you can teach those four components.
No, I would agree with that. It's a bit of a cliched question, but just before we move into the kind of highs and lows bit, if across your life really and career to date, if you were providing advice to 18-year-old Mark now, what would you be saying to him?
I think I'd probably say, essentially do as I think I did, and I think I knew roughly at that age, which is at almost any stage, don't worry too much about the future. I never had a plan. Some people do, and I do, it clearly works for them, but I never had a plan. So I think I would probably say, whatever you do, do it as well as you possibly can. I'm kind of competitive rather than ambitious, if you get the distinction. In every job I did, I wanted to be the person who kind of defined the way that job was supposed to be done. This is the sort of definitional approach to a job. And I think I say, do that. Do every job you can, you get, to the very best of your ability. Try and identify the things where you can make an impact in almost anything that you do or in everything that you do, and let the future take care of itself. And when you come towards the end, if you're in the kind of career you and I have had, where you have some fixed tours and so on, as you come towards the end of that, you're in the last year or the last 6 months, think about the next thing. But don't spend your life plotting the future and so on, because it's much better to do stuff than to be someone. And I think that's the advice I'd give. Yeah, sometimes when I talk to groups of that age, and of course I walk in with the CV behind me and now all the titles and letters after the name and all the rest of it. And I sometimes, I'll sometimes try just as almost the opening pitch to say to them, so you must all be wondering what, and I'll read out my kind of name and title and all the letters after the name and so on, which usually the person who's introduced me has just done, out of politeness. And so you must wonder what on earth I can say, I'm 30 years, 35 years older than you. Someone with all that can say that is remotely relevant to you at 18 or 20 or 22 or whatever it is. And I said, don't forget, none of that was true when I was your age. I didn't come from a background, didn't inherit any of this stuff. I didn't come from a background where any of that was expected, let alone inevitable. And so I try to, that's the kind of conversation I try to have with people. But do anything you can to the, make an impact in everything that you do. Let the future take care of itself. That's the advice I give to my 18-year-old son.
Yeah, such a great point. I think it's interesting as well. The more of these interviews I do, all of them obviously with people who have done well and continue to do well from a wide variety of backgrounds, one of the really major themes is competitive nature. Because I worry a little bit societally that we're in schools and so on, we're pushing to say, no, we shouldn't be so competitive. We need to be more open and everyone's got an equal opportunity and so on. And I think I get the equal opportunity point and everyone should be given the same life chances. But the reality is, of course, life is a competition and everything we do is competitive. And the sooner people get their heads around that, the better they're likely to be in terms of future success, I think.
Well, in some ways, I think, I agree with that. I mean, in some ways, when people ask me about how did you learn about leadership, I think I pretty much learned the really big components of good leadership from sports and captaining sides and so on as a teenager. And if you're captaining a side at school, there's a lot of kind of engagement to persuasive leadership, because there's no one more unforgiving than a bunch of teenagers who think, the skipper just thinks he's become the great I am and throwing his weight about. You very quickly get feedback that isn't going to work. And so you do. And I was never, the best player on almost any side. I was good at certain things, but I was never the absolute superstar sportsman. So I was never captaining anything from that kind of position. So I always had to try and captain in the sort of Mike Brearley way and sort of use my brains and personality to see if I could get a better outcome. And in some ways, I reckon I learned most of the big things about leadership probably by the time I was 18, to be honest, from that kind of experience.
And I think that's another valuable point, isn't it? That this is about a through life thing. It's not some magic, there's no magic fairy dust gets sprinkled on you at some point that turns you into a great leader. It is definitely an evolution over time, and you can have more opportunities occasionally in terms of the interventions that come along the way that give you better experiences and better kind of tools and tips. But a lot of it is stuff quite formative from a long time ago, and to exactly your point.
Well, I think as well, Bob, I think we often confuse leadership with position. You are the leader because you are the boss. It doesn't have to be true at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes the most junior member of a team can actually be the leader. If that's the person who convenes the five-a-side football or make sure that people's birthdays are remembered, or sorts out the Christmas the Christmas lunch, or puts their arm around someone who's having an off day and just checks in and makes sure that they're okay. That person is a leader. They don't have to be in charge to be a leader. And actually, if the really highest performing teams are teams of leaders, teams who have those qualities in them, and don't confuse leadership with position.
I totally agree again. And I think the other aspect of that is when you are in that kind of situation, even if you are the notional leader, recognizing that actually you're the, you need to be following someone at that point and being a good follower as well as being, a leader, because not everyone is good at that. As some people, try and still retain the kind of the I am, control, and that's not helpful in that context.
Yeah, I think, again, that's something the military does teach people. I remember my great friend Nick Parker, who was with me in Afghanistan. He's another great leader and another man from whom I shamelessly burgled some leadership techniques. Once talked about he runs a disaster relief charity now, and he talked about some of the military. Ex-military people that they use, and he made the comment that they don't only know how to lead, but they know how to be led. They used to both roles, and I think that if that learning to be led, learning to be a good follower, learning to be a leader within a team is a really important feature, and something I know the military do try to get right.
Yeah, interestingly, even at the Officers and Aircrew Selection Centre, the tests for which I don't think have changed for decades. The one of the things they do if you get far enough through the process is they do a whole lot of exercises, physical exercises in a hangar, which are moving stuff from A to B by and large, and shark infested swamp in the middle and that sort of thing. But the very first exercise they typically do there is a leaderless exercise. They don't appoint a leader. They'll just brief the team. This is what the requirement is, and you need to crack on and do it. And the reason they do it is to turn around and see who leads and how do the other people then follow and how do people react to other people's ideas and all the rest of it, for exactly that reason, because it is so important.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly right. And in those circumstances, does the leader just throw their weight about, or are they capable of creating essentially a collective leadership?
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember again a long, long time ago, I was taking a group of Duke of Edinburgh youngsters off into the desert. It was in Egypt at the time, and there was a flash flood. Not something that happens very often. And the guy who looked like the sort of superstar of the group, he was on the Gold Award, all the rest of it, just was essentially just completely passive, didn't really do anything. You know, he looked like a brilliant leader when in a very structured environment. When it went wrong, was you know, essentially ineffective. The two most effective people were two young women, Bronze Award candidates, who just quietly and effectively got on with what was needed to do, you know, shifting the camp, making sure that the stuff that needed to be kept dry was kept dry, et cetera, and just quietly got on with it in an unflustered way. And yet they were probably the previous day, they'd been the two quietest members of the group.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's a great example. I've got a section that I normally do here about reflections on highs, lows, and I always start with, when you look back, what would you, and I appreciate you may well turn around and say, I don't look back that much, because I certainly don't. I mean, I make a big thing of, you know, once I've made a decision, I look forward and that's it. But are there things across your career that you would have, you know, would do differently if you had your time again?
It's a good question. I mean, I'm genuinely a no regrets person. You do have to live your life forwards, and you make good decisions and bad decisions, and the bad decisions are formative, you know, as well. And you carry quite a lot of scar tissue when, particularly if you reach the sort of levels that I reached. I think if I look back, if I think of a couple of things that I still think actually maybe I should have done differently. There were two very senior jobs, including the last one as cabinet secretary, that I really didn't want. And I didn't feel that they were right for me. But because of circumstances, it felt, you know, I felt I had no choice but to say yes to them. And I still ask myself, what if I'd stood my ground? You know, none of us is indispensable. They'd have found someone else to run the Home Office. They'd have found someone else to be cabinet secretary. How would life have been different? I'd have probably pursued a purer diplomatic career. It would have probably, you know, I was already at a senior and successful level. I've been in Afghanistan. And I'd have probably been a better husband and father over the last 10 years and less stressed and sort of had an easier time of it. So I sometimes ask myself that kind of question. Some of the most difficult things I went through, of course you ask yourself, well, you know, actually, what could I have done differently? Usually, the things I look back on and think I should have done differently is when I delayed a decision that I knew I should take. And sometimes that was for good reasons. It might have been compassion around an individual who just wasn't really cutting it, and I just didn't really want to have the difficult conversation. On other occasions, yeah, it might be something structural. But, yeah, usually when I look back and think, actually, you did take the right decision in the end, but, my God, it took you too long to get there. And you sort of knew earlier on you should have just got on with it. And it's usually those things, I think, that you probably recognise you should have done differently.
It's really helpful. Thank you. And very candid as well. More positively then, what do you consider your most important achievement has been? And as you kind of get where you are now, what legacy are you thinking about or have thought about in terms of what you'd like to leave?
Well, I genuinely don't. I think if you start thinking about your legacy, then you're probably long past the time you should be moved on out of any particular job, because I think that's the point at which vanity starts to kick in. You start thinking about it's about you and not them. But if I look back, I think the things I'm sort of proudest of were, I think, my time in Afghanistan. Now, yeah, Afghanistan turned out tragically and unnecessarily tragically. And Bob, you and I could do a whole podcast on that, I'm sure.
Maybe we will. That'd be a good idea.
We'd find ourselves agreeing. But at the time, 2009 to 11, we had the surge of Western military and development and diplomatic effort. And there was a real sense that although we had some difficult, you know, really difficult years, the insurgency was really starting to take a grip in Afghanistan, that there was this opportunity to actually take this through to a successful conclusion. And if I look back on that period, I think, you know, I essentially devised and led what was called the transition program, where we transitioned authority, both military and civilian authority, away from the NATO forces and countries into Afghan hands. And I believe that was absolutely the right thing to do, because in the end, they have to take responsibility for their own country. And we did that in a structured way. I devised and led the first phase of that program. And I think that was the right thing to do. And I think it also, by the way, helped retain the coherence of the Western coalition, because it enabled Western governments to see there was a route out of Afghanistan, but it wasn't one which just became about withdrawal. It was one that was about transition and essentially equipping the Afghans to succeed. And I think, had that been seen through in that spirit, then I think the situation might well have turned out very differently. But that, I think, that was a genuine legacy moment, and people said that to me at the time. The thing I regret about that period was I was crystal clear that alongside that we needed a political process to try to bring the insurgent rather than terrorist part of the Taliban into the process, and in particular those tribes who weren't really ideologically committed to the Taliban but had essentially affiliated to them for a whole range of different reasons, and that we genuinely should bring them into the process and reach a political settlement, genuinely create reconciliation. And I had that argument fiercely with some of my colleagues, particularly in the US system, who were obviously dominant, and I wasn't really able to make that happen. And again, I feel if we'd been able to, particularly at the point we had the surge, talk when you have the upper hand. Don't think that because you seem to have the upper hand, that somehow or other is going to guarantee, a win, a positive outcome. Recognize that the mature, the sensible, the statesmanlike thing to do is actually we had the momentum with us. We definitely had regained the initiative at that period, and that was the time when our adversaries, you would have been more responsive. Whereas talks when they came at a point when we were essentially on the defensive, they had the momentum with them, and it wasn't possible to reach a sensible outcome. And I regret very much I just wasn't skillful enough to persuade the rest of the Western coalition. There were plenty of voices who agreed with me, but I wasn't skillful enough in that pivotal position to persuade the rest of the Western coalition to go down that track at a moment when I believe we could have achieved a successful outcome.
No, I think you're right. We could absolutely have a separate podcast on this for a lengthy period of time, because there's so much that was interesting from my time in Kandahar as well, where at the much more tactical level, I sensed I had lots of visitors, inevitably on a big base, particularly a lot of political visitors, and lots of them would ask, what do you think? How's it going to end? Those sort of questions. And the two things I would always say is I think the two big risks are long-term political will, not in Afghanistan, but outside Afghanistan in the coalition, and the desire to have the stomach to see it through to where we needed to get to. And the other one was internal to Afghanistan, was all about corruption, where, I just saw that everything we were doing on and off the base at Kandahar was really challenged by an environment where we would consider it corruption. They just consider it normal life. And I laugh with what I do or did, particularly when I was working at Deloitte, where we would do all sorts of stuff around financial compliance and so on, around anti-money laundering and these practices is not acceptable and all the rest of it. And actually, certainly when I was at Kandahar, with everything being dependent on stuff either being flown in or trucked in, that was the only way you could get it. And fuel, obviously, was trucked in, was a great example here. If Supreme Fuels had not factored in and paid tax, if you want, along the route, we wouldn't have got any fuel. I mean, it was essentially bribes to get through, and that was absolutely essential. And that was just the price of doing business. And I think we were naive in not recognizing how that would play out.
In some cases, we thought we were building institutions, and actually what we were doing was empowering one tribal group at the expense of another.
Yeah,
I think guess what? The one that felt they were on the wrong end of that affiliated to the Taliban.
Yeah,
And so I think you're right. I think we could do a long session on this, but if we look back, we eventually got it right. We focused on building genuine capability in the system, you know, the basic function of the state, law and order, building up a genuinely professional police force, trying to protect judges and the courts from the threats of violence, et cetera, that they faced, it deal with the drugs trade and organized crime and all the rest of it. And those should have been our focus right from the start. We did great things around education and health and other social programs. But in a state, the situation that Afghanistan found themselves in the early part of the century, those were almost luxuries compared to the absolutely core function, which is the rule of law. And if we'd focused on the rule, I mean, yeah, they're not incompatible. We could have done both. But the point was, we often felt that we were doing the right thing by focusing on really, you know, really effective and positive health and education programs, girls into school, all the rest of it. Great things to do, big societal impact, but actually neglected the rule of law. And it's harder to do. Aid agencies, particularly at the time, didn't really like devoting their resources to it. But that was absolutely fundamental, and that is one of the reasons that we didn't really have, for a long period, effective Afghan authorities to hand our own authority over to.
Mm. Now, I can completely understand why it's a high point for you, though, in terms of your time there. Most people, I think, in the Air Force would say commanding a squadron is a pinnacle point, then commanding a station, because once you reach that pinnacle, you want the next peak. What's the next one up there? Commanding a station. And I thought, right, that's the end of my flying career. That's the last time I'm going to do any amount of flying. What's going to be next? And actually, a year and a bit later, I went out to Afghanistan, and that was an amazing job. I mean, it was absolutely one of the high points of my career. Tinged with tragedy, of course. It was extraordinary, and I share your view. I mean, I think it was very, very sad the way it all played out in the final analysis.
I agree.
Off from that point, career low point. Got to have one of those. What's yours, and what did you learn from it?
I think the by far the worst thing I ever dealt with was when I was at the Home Office and the child sex abuse scandals broke. You're starting with the Savile affair and so on, but then all of everything that followed, and the hysteria that really followed that. You know, these allegations badly handled by the police, as it turned out, that there was somehow a massive conspiracy at the heart of the British establishment, and very senior and respected people, politicians, retired generals, and so on, were sort of caught up in it. And it felt for a while, I never believed it. It turned out, of course, that the allegations were a fabrication, and some very distinguished people had their reputations and sort of personal well-being damaged very badly at that time. And it was almost impossible to stand against that, because there was enough genuine child sexual abuse going on that the public fear, the general fear was well founded, but it was really, really difficult to handle all of that. And the other part I found really hard about, and we set up the inquiry and so on, that was very challenging as well. And the sense that somehow or other there was, trying to contest this idea that there was a deep plot. And I remember, I was almost accused at one point of having been directly responsible for the deletion of a set of files in a routine file management exercise. The deletions had happened while I was at school. And yet such was the furore surrounding it. There were very personal accusations that somehow or other I'd been responsible for because I was running the Home Office at the time. And of course it subsided in the end, and it was what I had to do was not look as though I was failing to get the seriousness of it. I was very clear that we should, and actually indeed set up investigations and so on ahead of the public inquiry in order to tackle it and understand exactly what had happened. But it was just phenomenally difficult to deal with in that public situation. And the other thing I found really hard about it is was retaining the professional perspective that one has to retain always as a leader in these circumstances. And yet I couldn't stop myself reacting as a father as well. And just the sheer anger I felt at what had happened to these thousands and thousands of young people and the way their lives have been affected by it and the cycle of abuse that tended to create and trying to deal with it without allowing that emotion to essentially overwhelm me. I just found it was by far the hardest thing I ever had to do.
Yeah, I can imagine. I remember actually when I was doing quite a lot of work with, amongst other things, GCHQ, and we were talking about cyber stuff at one point, and also I've done quite a lot of stuff with the police, where the conversations I've had with people at various stages around how they manage, I was just about to come on and talk about work-life balance, which is probably a good segue into this, but the detaching themselves from what they're dealing with on a day-to-day if they're in that kind of game. And there are people who are obviously on the dark web finding and catching bad guys. But in doing that, they're having to do and see and endure things that are just horrendous. And I think it's a real challenge to, I mean, I'm quite good at compartmentalizing things, but I really admire people who are doing that kind of level of work and able to properly compartmentalize it. Yeah. I think it's really tough.
It is critically important that people who are, as you say, engaged, particularly in the front line of that kind of work. Yeah, I felt it, and I was nowhere near that. Yeah, I wasn't dealing with the images and the individual cases. I just was aware of it all, and therefore I kind of understood the public wave of emotion around it because I felt it myself. But people in those circumstances, it is critically important they get professional counselling and all the support they need as they go through it, because it is traumatic.
Yeah, 100%, very much so, very much so. And that is a segue into work-life balance. I mean, you've still are actually living in a world, as you alluded, made clear at the front with what you're doing now. You've got a very busy life. You've had some very busy, very stressful, very demanding jobs. How do you personally manage the work-life balance de-stress thing, and what kind of top tips would you offer?
So I think everyone has to find their own way to it. And so if I talk to people about this, I will always say to them, look, you've just got to make sure that you're consciously managing that, and that you have other things in your life other than work, and you devote time and energy to them, whether that's family life or sport or art or whatever it might be. But be really conscious that it is right to do this, and remember, I will say to people who are very dedicated public servants, I said, don't forget, there is only one place you are genuinely indispensable, genuinely irreplaceable, and that's with your family. Yeah. Work, no matter how important you think you are, actually, it will go on. And so I would always, if someone had an issue at home, whatever it is, say, look, just get away, take the time you need, and focus on your family. And by the way, that wasn't just, I think it's the right thing to do, but it was also the most effective thing to do, because if people are feeling, where I've seen people get into really serious difficulties, mental health difficulties, is when work and family life or work and home life are going wrong at the same time. You can deal with one being really hard, but if both are really hard at the same time, you have nowhere to go. And so I always, I would always encourage people to maintain a really healthy investment in their family life. And so I literally maintained a balance in that for a long time. Really, shortly after I got back from Afghanistan, the family moved out of London. I would do the weekly commute. So I'd be working in London during the week and devote all the time I needed to that. But then at the weekend, I would try to get away from it. you know, not spend all my time emailing and working and so on. You have to do a bit, but not spend my time doing that. Devote my time, yeah, and sort of presence physically to my family and to life outside London. And also the other thing I always did, even when I was a youngster just living in a flat in town and so on, most of my I've sometimes been criticized for, very few of my friends are work colleagues. You know, I've always had friendly relationships with work colleagues, and you know, and so on. But my friendships are nearly all from other areas of life, where people therefore might be interested in what I do, but they don't know me as the ambassador, the permanent secretary, the cabinet secretary, the whatever. They know me as Mark, and they know me as a person in the village, or in, you know, just as a mate, at the rugby club, or you know, whatever it might be. And so that's how I always maintain it. And I remember, even when I was quite young, seeing more and more people lose their old, say, university friends, and becoming, you know, their friendships becoming more and more entangled in their work life, and thinking, no, I'm really not going to do that, and almost preventing myself becoming, you know, friends as opposed to friendly with work colleagues, in order to maintain, you know, to devote my effort to maintaining my friendships elsewhere.
That's a really interesting point, actually, because when as you were saying that, I was thinking about my friends, and partly because I guess I spent 34 years in an Air Force, which for a large part of that was migratory. We were moving around all over the place, and often bumping into the same people and working with the same people all the time. I'm a bit the opposite. A lot of my friends are Air Force friends. Not all, obviously, but the it's very interesting. No, it's a great point. Thank you very much. One of the things I always do when I've got great guests like you with amazing backgrounds is not just talk about personal leadership, but actually tap you for a bit of wider view, as it were, of what's going on, because you've got huge experience. You're still very much involved in global affairs, and your your engagement in that at very senior level is clearly still important. What do you see as the kind of key global challenges right now? And I accept we definitely could have a whole podcast on this, but just in short form, the things that are out there that were crystal ball gazing, but where probably we need to be focusing most attention over the coming years.
Sure. Well, it's kind of, you sound still involved. I mean, I think I'm sort of off the pitch and into the commentary box probably now, although I guess through the House of Lords, at least, if not on the pitch, not too far from it.
I think chairman of the Atlantic Futures Forum counts you as still being involved.
Yeah. But but again, one isn't actually sort of a policymaker, let alone an operator in the way I was as an ambassador or and so on. I mean, I think in essence, they're pretty self-evident. I think there's two or three things that are going to dominate. And how they interact with each other are going to dominate over the next 20, 25 years. And I do think it's important to try and keep that kind of perspective out to the mid-century. First is climate change. We're already seeing the effects of increasing volatility in the weather, and that is set to continue because it's non-linear. And so as we go through each half a degree, if you like, there'll be, you know, more and more volatility in the weather. And how do we maintain the investment to achieve net zero alongside the investment that will have to be made to adapt our countries and societies to deal with the climate effects that are already locked in? More barriers across major rivers, those kind of things. These are massive investments, land use, all the rest of it. And maintaining both is going to be a huge challenge for all countries. By the way, even countries like China, you know, are probably more affected by climate change, low-lying, et cetera, than many, many others. And the potential crises for small island states, for countries with big deltas like Bangladesh or Nigeria, the impact on migratory flows, all of that. And that is the biggest, that is by far, that set of issues around climate change is by far the biggest affecting us. And we have to try and make sure that whatever the geopolitical tensions, that we're able still to take effective action on that. I think second is the technological revolution, nearly all positive, huge opportunities to improve productivity, wealth, et cetera, but of course, like all, and this is a mixture of different technologies, all happening at the same time, if you like. But of course, like all other technological advances, particularly happening when you have a series of technologies coming together at the same time, there will be cost, there'll be dislocation, disruption to, if you like, 20th century employment, as well as new opportunities. There's clearly risks, as well as huge opportunities around the use of AI and so on. And so managing all of that is going to be a huge challenge, but that will affect it. And countries that get that right will prosper, and countries that don't will fall behind. And that's true for individuals as well. I think third, there are huge demographic challenges. Every country faces, pretty much outside sub-Saharan Africa, has aging populations. And how do we ensure that the social protection, social model is sustainable and affordable? We're all facing that. And of course, technology is part of the answer to that, but only part of the answer. And then finally, I think it's the geopolitical, geoeconomic challenges. So we obviously have the massive crisis of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But if we'd been having this conversation 3 or 4 years ago, that would have been one of several flashpoints that we might have identified as potentially tipping into crisis in the subsequent few years. And there are still several around the world which might well also tip into crisis the way that has with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But underlying that, you have US-China rivalry and all this language around a second Cold War. And it's worth keeping in mind that at some point in the 2040s or 50s, the Chinese, US, and Indian economies are going to be pretty much the same size, most likely. I mean, it's a long way off to make predictions. But if you look at the sort of central forecasts, China will catch up with the US, but India will catch up with China at some point in around the mid-century. And that's going to be a different world to the one that we've had before. And we're naturally focused on this binary argument, this binary tension, if you like, between Beijing and Washington and how the world lines up around that. But India, as we've seen with the recent G20, is clearly positioning themselves, and I think this goes with their political traditions, to be the leader of essentially a new non-alignment, a group of countries that want to have positive relations with both Beijing and Washington are absolutely determined not to find themselves facing a choice between the two. So the world, the geopolitical world and geoeconomic world, is going to become more and more fluid and complex, I think, over the next 25 years. And policymakers, whether in London or Brussels or Paris or Berlin or wherever, Tokyo and Beijing and Washington and Delhi, are going to be facing all of those things. And they're all happening at once. And it's that there's a word for it. It's complexity. The world is in a phase of unprecedented and fluid complexity, and will be for the next quarter century.
That's a really great answer to a very complex question. So thank you very much. I mean, just a slight segue on, and just to carry the theme, talk about the US. When I interviewed David Petraeus, he was clear. He talked a lot about challenges and the plate spinning effectively that is going on, that, and was quite clear in his own mind that the US still had to be at the forefront of managing and leading the response to a lot of those challenges. When you look, though, at the current US political situation and the division, which, I mean, I've spent lots of time in the US, as of you, and it really worries me. I've never seen it so divided. It seems to be a narrative that is threatened in terms of the US's continued global leadership role. What do you think? Where do you think that'll end up?
Yeah, well, I think I agree wholeheartedly with Dave Petraeus that the United States remains essentially the indispensable nation. And people talk about China's ambitions, but actually there's no real sign that China has the ambition to replace the United States as the world leader. What they have the ambition to do is to be the dominant player in their own hemisphere, and essentially to ensure that they're not constrained by their rivalry with the United States. But they don't aspire to have that world-leading role that the United States has really had since World War II, and of course in a much more dominant way since the end of the Cold War. And I think the United States does remain the indispensable nation. It is still the world's largest economy, huge innovation, and so on. By far the world's most effective military power. I mean, people focus very much on the moment on rising military powers. Let's not forget the United States still outspends the next 10 nations combined, pretty much. It may not be 10 anymore, but it'll certainly be 8 or 9. You create more innovation in defense than anyone else. Don't take on the United States. Never underestimate the ability of the American economy to adapt. So, of course, it's critically important. And like you, I do worry about this rising isolationism. And people tend to focus that around the personalities. But actually, I think President Trump and others are essentially riding that wave rather than generating it. We saw even in President Obama's time, he used the language of nation building at home when he was talking about retrenching from Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. And we've seen a rising sense of isolationism or protectionism, including with the Biden administration's some of their legislation. And I think that is a secular trend in the United States at the moment. We've seen it before. It happened in the parts of the 19th century, happened in the 20s and 30s after between the wars. And it is worrisome. I think, of course, the question then is, okay, what can the rest of us do about that? And some aspire to say, okay, well, there's an opportunity, there's a vacuum to be filled and someone else can fill it. I don't really buy that. I don't think the European Union among our allies is in a position to do so. And of course, we don't really want the vacuum to be filled by others who have a different value set for obvious reasons. But the best thing the rest of us can do is show we will share the burden. The thing, I met President Trump several times, and the thing that you got from him was not, and he as almost the sort of spokesman for that wing, if you like, in American politics. The thing you got from him wasn't that a refusal for the United States to be involved in the world, but anger that he perceived that America's allies were free riding and were not sharing the burden adequately. And he had a point. I wouldn't have expressed it the way he did, nor would Dave Petraeus or many other Americans, but they will recognize that he had a point. And the best way that the UK, America's other allies, whether in Europe or the Asia Pacific and so on, keep the United States engaged to show we'll share the burden, we'll do our part. And that means increasing defense expenditure, being active, promoting our economic and political values and so on.
I think that's really great summary. And I totally agree. I mean, on that, the particularly US contribution, I mean, I think certainly last time I looked at it, they were basically paying about 75% of the total NATO bill, which, I mean, how does that work? It's ridiculous. Yeah. Obviously, there should be greater burden sharing across the nations. And if we're not prepared to look after our own security, then I don't agree with much what Donald Trump says either. But at the same time, I think he does have a point in those sorts of areas for sure. I would be not forgiven by many, I suspect, for having a former cabinet secretary and head of the civil service on the podcast and not talking about UK politics briefly. I know you probably don't want to get into personalities and sort of detail of any policies and bits, but we're also in a situation of kind of pretty unprecedented in, as far as I can see, political turmoil. What's your take on how this ends and where it's going to go, reflections on the kind of UK parliamentary system as it is right now?
Yeah. Well, I'm just back from a visit to Singapore, and I was there this time last year as well. And just as the Truss government was essentially running into what proved to be existential challenges. And essentially the point that I was made, actually not, this was an international gathering, complaint was made was people couldn't really understand why the UK had been so introspective for much of the previous decade. And I take that back to the 2014 referendum in Scotland, as well as the 2016 Brexit referendum, that essentially we've been through a period when, instead of just being the rest of the world not really taking an interest in what's going on within the UK, because it was kind of sometimes left of centre, sometimes right of centre, but fundamentally the UK was a predictable and active member of the international community, pro-free trade, pro-globalisation, pro-the-rules-based system, willing to intervene alongside others, whether politically or militarily or economically and so on, and sort of active and influential in the world. And we spent a decade essentially, as the rest of the world sees it, talking to ourselves, about ourselves. And there was a sort of impatience saying, well, okay, when are you going to get over that? When are we going to have you back again as players in global affairs? Because there's a genuine appetite for that. Rather surprising, we sometimes flatter ourselves, but there is a genuine appetite for that. And so, I think that perspective is one that I think it's important political leaders here understand that. Of course, all countries, all governments are elected in the end on domestic policy, running a successful economy, all of that. But there is an appetite for the UK to be engaged in the world. And because we're a very open and society and economy, it is in our interest that we are. And we should remember that. Now, of course, I'm a diplomat. Yeah, I would say that, wouldn't I? But I genuinely believe that to be the case. I think the second thing is that we haven't really identified what, in particular, the post-Brexit economic model is going to be. Whether you're for or against Brexit, it is a major change of direction in our economic as well as political position, and a shift to less economic integration with our neighbours in Europe and more free trade agreements, etc., elsewhere. That's the shift that has followed. But we've almost continued domestically as though we could just carry on as before. And again, whether you're for or against Brexit, you have to accept it is a major change of direction. And I don't think we've really had a proper national conversation around what that change of direction means. And quite a lot of it means that people are essentially simply believing that nothing has changed and we can simply go on as things were before. And I just don't believe that's the case. It's a major change in our economic model. And at some point, that has to become a feature of politics. And I think the third thing I'd say is that our government, like governments everywhere else, over the next 20 years, 20, 25 years, are going to have to wrestle with these really big challenges, all of which are put pressure on budgets, on inflation, on tax and all the rest of it, whether it's climate change, the technological revolution, aging populations, geopolitical tensions, etc. Those are the things that are fundamental changes that are going to affect our politics just like they're everyone else's. And yet, actually, the next election will probably be about a whole range of other issues, not those. And that's the nature of domestic politics. But actually, what's going to change, determine the success of this country or whether we prosper or whether we fall behind compared to others is how we adapt to those really big things that are going on in the world.
Absolutely fascinating. We could have a much longer discussion about all of this, that's for sure. There's two questions I always ask on these podcasts, and they're brief ones, I think. But what's the most memorable event of your life so far, not just career?
Becoming a father.
Yeah, that's a straightforward.
Yeah. And the most important.
Yeah. No. The briefest answer I think I've had, but it's crystal clear. That's fantastic. But the last one then is equally interesting one with the variation in answers I get to this. But what's the most difficult question you've ever been asked?
I don't know really. That one probably, because I don't have an obvious answer to it. In some ways, the most difficult questions. I did a a session at a local school recently with a bunch of early teens, an audience of early teens. We were talking about Ukraine and a whole range of different things. And then suddenly, and it was a Q&A, and you suddenly get questions completely out of left field from them. Well, what do you think about abortion? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? And in some ways, the most difficult questions are the really straightforward ones from young people who just want an answer. And they aren't looking for a clever piece of political or official or Humphrey-ish ease. What they're just looking for is an answer. And answering those authentically, I must admit, is including things which I may not have even expected. I'm perfectly happy to answer difficult questions about Ukraine or Afghanistan or even British politics. But things of that kind, questions about personal values and so on, are probably the ones I'm least comfortable with.
Yeah, actually, I've had a very similar answer from others on that as well with kids, where they come up with some real left field, unexpected questions that you go, I haven't really thought about how I'm going to answer that.
Yeah, or even if you have, it's a question. In interviews like this, you don't usually tend to ask questions that feel quite personal. But kids don't have that filter. They just ask the question because they're interested in they want to know what you think.
Yeah.
And sometimes you think, that's something I don't necessarily feel very comfortable with.
Well, Mark, you've been very generous with your time. Predictably, it's been an absolutely fascinating session. I think you've been really candid and have got amazing views on so many things. And there are so many other things that we could actually have a longer discussion about. But I'm extremely grateful to you. Thank you very much indeed. It's been tremendous.
Bob, it's been a pleasure. And my very best wishes for you and for the success of the podcast as a whole.
Thank you very much. That's really kind.